From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with David Windsor. This morning we speak with Kyra Wong. She is the founder of Pain Free Studio in Park City. She's also a postural alignment specialist and an accredited exercise therapist trained at the Egoscue Institute. We look forward to that conversation. And then in the second half, creative director at the Pantone Color Institute and author of the new book, Deep Color, Keith Recker. Keith will talk about how color is such a powerful force in our lives, a significant influence in visual and verbal communication, and also on the decisions we make every day. That's all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm David Windsor.
Our next guest, Kyra Wong, is the founder of Pain Free Studio in Park City. She is a postural alignment specialist and an accredited exercise therapist trained at the Egoscue Institute. The Egoscue method, created by Pete Egoscue, also a Park City resident, is first and foremost about helping people change their posture and be more comfortable in their bodies. And this method of posture therapy is the world leader in non-medical pain relief. Kyra Wong, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much.
Well, it's great to have you back. It's been a long time since we've spoken with you. Tell us first how what you do at Pain Free Studio differs from an Egoscue clinic.
It's fairly similar to an Egoscue clinic. I had a clinic for many years and then just became an affiliate, which gave me a little more freedom as I added more knowledge and more elements. I became a yoga teacher and I studied Pilates and I got really into looking at the body as a unit, which is actually what Pete Egoscue taught us in the first place. So as I've continued down this road 20 years later, I've also gotten really into how trauma and really the mind-body connection and inflammation and all of that all plays into this idea of posture. And some of that is because I've had the privilege of working with people that, for instance, have had Parkinson's and things like that. And I've really watched when you take away dopamine from the brain, for instance, what happens to the posture and how this sort of mind-body connection all works together. And that kind of kept leading me down to like what's actually monitoring what's holding us in space. And when that goes awry or when things get loose or tight, what's actually playing into that? So we think like muscles stretch, but they don't actually stretch. It's a chemical and mechanical way that they slide over each other. And that really has to do with what's happening in the brain and what's happening in the, how much inflammation is in the body or how much it's not. So when I do an intake with people now, where before maybe I would just take postural photos, now I'm much more interested in what's the history of their body? What's the history of their injuries? Were they involved in trauma, mental or physical traumas throughout their life? And how does that lead to the picture that I'm looking at? And what do they believe about how they can get better or not?
Wow, it's so holistic. It's such a big, big thing. And of course, you can have all the balance, you can strengthen what's weak and all of that. But as you say, what about if you have an inflammatory lifestyle or diet?
Yeah.
And, you know, as I think about it, and especially aging and thinking about things like arthritis, the possibility of that happening and knowing that so much of that is about inflammation, something
absolutely.
You look
absolutely. And it leads to pain and also the pain signals that are happening in our body. So the greater the inflammation, the more likely we are to have muscles shut down, specifically those deep skeletal muscles that are responsible for holding our posture. And when those are shutting down, we see balance and things like that change greatly. So I sort of think of it like there's three layers of muscles, the deep ones that run the rotators in your shoulders or your hips or the muscles along your spine, your psoas is included, some of the deep, deep neck muscles. And if those are shut down and they're not being able to monitor your position in space anymore, then you have a less precise movement every time you move at all. And that imprecision of the movement creates wear and tear, which gives the possibility of inflammation. Now, if your gut, for instance, is inflamed and you have more inflammatory cytokines happening from your joints, then that's playing back and forth into each other. And recently, I was just experiencing going off of a medication, for instance, and I was like, wow, I'm in more pain. And I was like, okay, well, I would like to not feel that pain. So I need more serotonin happening in my body. And I was like, well, 95% of the serotonin that's happening in my body is made in my gut. And that definitely makes me have the ability to feel less pain. So it really is. And Pete Egoscue was real, you know, he was really the first one that said the body's a unit. Like, not only is the foot connected to the hip, connected to the shoulder, and the site of the pain isn't always the problem in your body, we also have this incredible mind-body connection. And if you've had early childhood trauma, for instance, then you have more heightened pain receptors potentially in your body because you were exposed to a bunch of stress when you were at some point in your life. And now with COVID, we've all just been exposed to a huge stressor.
I want to circle back. You were talking about Parkinson's, and my father-in-law has Parkinson's. And I know that's just something that is, it just continues on obviously throughout. And so what are the things that the Egoscue method is implementing to allow that those receptors in the brain to help with that type of disease?
Yeah, so some is just using the neural pathways as much as possible. So staying as active as we can. And we know that bike riding and things like that have some really great aspects to just keep you moving, because exercise in general is going to give you more ATP, for instance, which is going to help reduce the pain. That's how we have muscles contract. So the simple act of muscles contracting is important. But we also see some very specific things that happen in Parkinson's, a head tilt, tightening of the abdominal wall, bending over, the skeletal muscles don't respond as well as they need to, just that lack of dopamine and what that's telling the body exists. So people really need to continue to do some kind of postural exercise and maintain what they have. So definitely move. And I really think that there's some link between Parkinson's and the gut. I have yet to meet someone that has any of those diseases that don't have some kind of major exposure to some kind of chemical or, you know, yeast, or there's been all kinds of stuff that they've played with. I don't think we know completely, but being able to say, you know, really be on top of eating an anti-inflammatory diet.
I agree with you on that. I've heard a lot about studies with gluten and the Parkinson's. So what about preventative measures for individuals? We live in a very active ski town, and you know my history, Kyra, with my back and stuff, but what are some of the preventative measures as people can do in this town that are constantly active to make sure that they're preventing those injuries using your methods?
Yeah, I think that being able to begin to understand your own posture is really important. And so looking at, you know, do you have a shoulder that's higher than another? Do you have a hip that's higher than another? Similar to what a chiropractor might tell you when you go see them. The difference for the Egoscue method is that we're giving you a set of exercises for you to do specifically to help bring back that position so that you're continuously working on it. We all have patterns in our body, and maybe it's from sports that we've played, or I was a competitive snowboarder, so I was really twisted while I was competing, and that created some changes while I was developing in my hips and pelvis that, you know, I don't twist very well to the other direction. I should have road switch more or something, but the way that my pelvis and spine developed as I grew from the time I was probably 12 to 18 while I was in that, or 22 in that competitive time, there's some differences in my body that I need to continue to work on. And when I take the best responsibility for my body, working on that on a regular basis and saying, okay, how do I keep myself level so that I can bend and flex well? One of the activities that's really challenging for people, especially if their body's out of alignment, is shoveling. And hopefully this winter, we're going to get a lot of snow. And that flexed, bent over, twisted position and then lifting some load is like one of the biggest recipes to create a bulge or a herniation or even just a muscle spasm as something hits a nerve. And so being able to use good spine hygiene, lift, you know, with your legs bend at your hips, not have so much rounding, like the education of that is important, but also walking into that activity with a body that's not already really crooked is a really great idea.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Kyra Wong. She's the founder of Pain-Free Studio here in Park City. It's painfreestudio.com. And Kyra, I have to say, I logged in early this morning to your website and I went through some of the great little short videos that you offer, which is wonderful. It was a great way to start my day. And, you know, just things from hip openers and, you know, you have this exercise about changing your body's reaction to what we do when we hunch forward and, you know, work at a computer all day. It's so much about creating our body's ability to go into an activity, like you say about shoveling, with strength and balance. Yeah. And less about, you know, maybe treating the problems that happen afterwards. It's about, isn't it, creating this body so those issues don't happen?
Yeah, in the best way, we'd have bodies that we know that we have to work on. I think, you know, it'd be wonderful if we learned things in school as a kid, how to breathe, how to calm ourselves down, how to keep our bodies in really good alignment. Like that would be wonderful, how to be in this organism that we're in and how it works. Unfortunately, that's, unless you're really lucky, not what you're taught in school. But as we get to take ownership of this body that we're in, how do we calm it down, open it up, recognize when it's really out of alignment? And the challenge of living in a society and a culture where we're doing things where that our bodies are adapting to that are more and more challenging to combat. So I think we're 9 years that everyone's had a cell phone basically, and the position of holding your hands in like this and leaning your head over for sometimes some people we're looking at like 5 hours a day is really challenging to how our body is adapting to holding our heavy head up and what it's doing to our hands and our shoulders. And then, you know, you want to go play football with your kid after you've been in that position forever and your shoulder no longer has the ability to go behind you because the muscles in the front of the chest are so tight, you're much more likely to get injured. So when we look at our bodies as just that they're constantly adapting to the stimulus that we're providing, if that stimulus is sitting crooked all the time, then that's what your body's beginning to adapt to. And we know that our bodies need movement and sunshine and good nutrition and community. And I had the privilege of going to a yoga class at the shop that just reopened recently. And, you know, we were all like in tears because it's just been so long since we've been there. And just being able to go move together and be like, wow, this is a community that supported each other was like really emotional. You could feel all those really good hormones and neurotransmitters happening in your body as there was like some emotional release even. And while I think the movement that they were providing, Tiffany Wood was providing, is, you know, she's incredibly good at the technique that she's teaching you, but also the whole rest of the package of that was so important.
Absolutely. We had the great pleasure to speak with Pete Egoscue a couple of years ago on this show. Something so interesting that stood out from that, I was talking to him about my son's scoliosis that he's had ever since he was a toddler. Pete suggested that, oh no, he didn't come into the world with that scoliosis. He got it somehow. And later in the conversation, he talked about how kids need to crawl, babies need to crawl longer and don't encourage them to walk. My son walked at 8 months. And of course, we thought it was just so amazing. You know, we encouraged it. And things like that. I mean, I just, that has stuck with me. And I'd love to get your take on that. And then also, you know, talking about that to new parents.
Yeah, the brain wires itself from these cross motor patterns. And There's lots that we don't know about scoliosis. There's some genetic markers that we can look at that are there. There's also lots of things that are injuries and even little traumas. So did your child fall in a certain way that created a crimp in the nerves, or did the nervous system react in a certain way that the body then wanted to avoid some position? And kids fall a lot. So that question, there's some cranial sacral therapists and things that are looking at the gates of the pelvis and the gates around the neck. And do we continuously have a trauma response? And does that change it? And there is some research that suggests that kids that don't crawl have more dyslexia and some things like that. And I would say we don't exactly know all the links about it, but the longer that we can have that cross body motion and the longer that we can develop ipsilateral movement pattern, I believe is what it's called, that then translates into better hip position, better spinal position, better shoulder position over time. And it seems to be better. So playing, even now with the kids that I see that have scoliosis, I ask their parents to set obstacle courses up for them because kids don't love to do postural exercises like therapy. So I make them, set up chairs or benches in the hallway and make them crawl over them and under them and all of that stuff so that it's a game, but that they're using their shoulders and their hips and their cross body motion. And I would say even my Parkinson's patients are often crawling around their living rooms when I'm working with them. One, it's a position that's usually not painful for them, but also good for the brain and good for the body.
I think we should do these interviews more often because I find myself working on my posture the entire time I'm talking to you, Kyra.
Good.
If someone is in pain and needs to seek your services, walk us through some of the things that's going to happen when at Pain Free Studio. What are they going to get into when they walk into the studio and work with you? And how does the assessment work? And how do you cater to each individual?
I would say that I'm in a phase of learning right now and trying to sort of figure out what it's going to look like when I grow up again. But the assessment is starting to be longer. I'm much more interested, like I said, in what the history is, down to how often did people use antibiotics or what do they know about that history, to know what is creating the health of their gut, into if people are willing to talk about it, what are the traumas that they experienced were in, because that mind-body connection does play in. People like John Sarno, who's a doctor who's no longer with us, really talked about that when there's unresolved grief and anger, that gets stored in the spinal muscles, and that's your body going into that fight or flight system. And then how often did it get triggered into that fight or flight and then doesn't have the ability to rest and relax? On the flip side of that, we adapt because of stress. That's how we adapt as humans. So I don't think that it's all bad, but I do think sometimes we need to go back and allow that stuff to arise and deal with it. And then I'm, of course, still looking at posture. So standing postural assessment, as well as what muscles are working and what muscles are not working so well. And then kind of putting that whole picture together to create a plan for someone to say, what's your prescription now? How would you like to add some anti-inflammatory things into what you're doing with your food? And how would you like to go into the exercises? And is that, small therapeutic type exercises, or am I pushing you towards being able to ski off the top of Jupiter? So whatever the goals are of the client is really what I'm trying to match that to. But that would be kind of where we're headed, I think.
From what I understand, you're giving people a full-on program, including a dietary path that they can use when they leave your studio and your services. I mean, so are you actually walking people through the types of diets and foods and everything that they can eat, or are you just kind of assessing the problem and letting them know where it came from?
I'm mostly asking the client where they're ready to start, because some people are like, give me the whole shebang. And some people are like, let's just look at the fact that my hip is elevated and my back hurts. So really it's, how far do you want to take this? And do you want to come see me twice and have a postural assessment and have a set of exercises that you're doing on a regular basis? Or do you want more of a comprehensive program to assess and address some of these other aspects? And the more I get into it, the more I think it all relates to each other. And finally, there are some other medical professionals, doctors, that are starting to have like a neuroendocrine, you know, the kind of title, so that they're looking at hormones and psychology and all kinds of stuff in looking at this whole interplay between our bodies and how they're working.
It's so interesting. Just in the last month, we've spoken with two gastroenterologists who talk about the health gut, Shilpa Ravella and Robin Shutkin. They're both just amazing women who have done so much work in this area and connecting it like you do. So they're coming at it as being doctors, you know, gut doctors, and you're coming at it from this very, you know, what started off being sort of an orthopedic look at things.
Yeah, very much. And I thought that I was even expanding my view of practice from, you know, when I was just working with pain in the foot to address that the foot was hurting and we were going to do foot exercises, just to include the whole rest of the body felt like a big sort of scan out of my microscope. And then as I keep going, it's like, wow, what's really not connected into this whole piece? And I've had to, in my own body and my own idea, let go of some stigmas that I had around like figuring out about serotonin, for instance, and being like, okay, I was in enough pain that one of the solutions was to go on an antidepressant. And then that opened a whole idea of how the brain and the body and this interplay between them is happening. But then going like, well, okay, I can add this and it definitely helped, but is there another way that I could be paying attention to getting more serotonin in my body? Or why am I not getting enough to be able to handle the amount of pain that I'm experiencing just by itself? And that really, by changing my diet, dropping gluten, shifting a bunch of things, within 3 or 4 days, it completely shifted. And I was like, great. Now I don't have to, like, now I know the levers that I'm playing with. And, you know, I've been a bit of a biohacker, so some of that's okay. And some of that is on the fringe of this cutting edge place of medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. I know our listeners will be like, a biohacker, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, I have wanted to play with the levers in my brain and my body to see how it works. And as I've played with, my husband used to say, you have a new way of eating every 3 weeks. And I was like, well, I'm trying to figure out what it does. If that's the fuel that I'm putting into my body, how does that change how I'm feeling or what's working or how much energy I have? And the same thing is true when I started to play with exercise. I've had the privilege of working with some shamans. So being able to address early childhood traumas of in my life also that I believe affected some of the ways that my brain works and develops, and being able to say, okay, what's the emotional history and how do I also go about releasing some of the stuff that was stored in my system?
So Kyra, how can people find you and what can they do to seek your services?
Yeah, you can find me at Pain Free Studio. I'm working out of Resilience right now. My practice is pretty full these days. And like I said, I imagine that, I'll create a new office or do something soon as I keep figuring this stuff out and what I want my practice to continue to look at. But for now, you can find me at painfreestudio.com. I also teach postural classes that I Zoom Tuesday and Thursday morning at Silver Mountain. And you can find the Zoom information also on the front page of my website if you want to join in. Or those recorded classes, they're not great quality. They're just Zoom recordings, but at my YouTube channel for free, if you're just interested in what kind of exercise, and that's at Pain Free Studio as well on YouTube. There's like 100 classes from during COVID, and there's meditations. Each class is about 45 minutes of movement and 15 minute meditation.
That's great. So as you get busier and busier in your individualized, really precision practice, Are you bringing on other therapists to take on some of the load?
Good question. I think I've been in a phase of developing my assessment, both movement assessment, learning from other people like Stuart McGill, as well as Pete Egoscue. There's a physical therapist named Shirley Sharman who is like 85 now, and she's brilliant. She created a method. So I'm trying right now to take a bunch of the people I've had the privilege to learn from, John Friend as well, that have different ideas about posture. I'll just say that's amazing and confusing, because when you get into this place, you have experts that disagree. And so being able to put all those tools in my toolbox and figure out how I can create the best assessment that works for me and then add these other pieces into it. I think once I figure that out, then yes, I will be able to teach other people what I'm doing, but I'm not quite there yet.
I think David and I might want to sign up to have you teach us so we can teach, share this knowledge. But for right now.
Yeah, well, David's been a client recently. So, and it's challenging. David, can I talk a little bit about your back?
Yeah, for sure.
So David has a place in his back that is slipping. I think when we talk about some of the emotional aspects of this, like he's been a super strong guy who plays golf all the time, who is having a hard time swinging a golf club or jumping, or what you said the other day was like even helping your friends move, right? Like being able to be of service in a way that you've always been able to show up as a big, strong guy and then say like, I can't do that. The piece that challenges your identity when something like this happens is also wrapped up in some of this aspect. And so being able to say like, yes, this is true. And how can we sort of, in Stuart McGill's language, gristle and stiffen the space that's slipping? And is that possible to do that with the tools that we have? Or has it gotten to a place where we need a bigger intervention?
Ira Wong, painfreestudio.com. Kyra, thank you so much for joining us on Mountain Life. The holiday season is a season of color, and color is a powerful force in our lives. It's a major influence in visual and verbal communication and on the decisions we make every day. Our next guest, Keith Recker, is a creative director at the Pantone Color Institute and quite literally can talk about color in such a way that even in the absence of a visual experience of color on this radio program, he can summon visions for all of us. He presents his new book, Deep Color, The Shades That Shape Our Souls, which is not only a visual feast, but it's historical and filled with little known facts about color and the way it influences our lives. Keith Recker, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
This is so interesting. I said to you when you came on the Zoom call that I was expecting these huge splashes of color in your background. And then I was a bit surprised to see a white background. And it's very intentional. Why is that?
I need to be in a white room or a dark black room because I can't handle the distractions of color when I'm writing about color. It's such a compelling, engulfing experience that I need a moment to step back from it in order to be clear and objective and effective about it.
The colors that aren't actually colors, I think most of us are not really familiar with the color wheel. And you say that you talk about the whole spectrum of the rainbow, and then in parentheses, even black, white, and pink. And how does pink figure into being classified along with black and white?
Yeah, well, we have to back up for 1 second and talk about the rainbow. Because the rainbow, as we understand it today, Roy G. Biv, right, was really invented by Isaac Newton in 1666 to 1670. He's the one who organized the seven colors of the rainbow as we think of it today. And interestingly, if you back up and look at a rainbow in the sky, you would be very hard pressed to find two values of blue, right? Because we have blue and indigo in Roy G. Biv. And you would probably be pretty hard pressed to find orange too. The reason that Newton pushed through from what's more like 4.5 colors or 5 to 7 is that he wanted to find a parallel to the days of the week and the notes of the musical spectrum. He wanted to find like a unified way of seeing reality. And so 7 is a mystical number, right? So he slotted the rainbow in with seven. So orange and indigo should be super grateful to Isaac Newton. And at that moment, when he defines what colors are in the spectrum, he leaves out black and white. And for the first time, black and white are no longer considered colors. So that's all super recent, the notion that black and white are non-colors. And I thought, you know, they're also the first terms to enter human languages around the world consistently as color terms. So they've had the most time to accumulate meaning. So I couldn't not write a book about color without black and white. And pink is a special favorite of mine because it comes very late into Western languages, like the end of the 15th, early 16th century. And it only kind of achieves a certain power, identity, and distinction in the Rococo era in the late 1700s. And at that moment, it plants itself as a fresh, young, playful, merry kind of color that is not gendered, by the way. And yet you see it morph over time into a purely feminine color in the world post-World War II era, with all kinds of reasons for that change. And then you see it morph into a color of super powerful purpose at the height of the AIDS era. And then again for women's health with breast cancer just after the height of the AIDS era. And then you see it erupt again in 2017 in the hot pink pussy hat, right? So it goes from being this playful, fresh thing to a totally powerful protest color, one of the two top protest colors of our time. So how can I avoid those three? They're so good.
As a society, we've been primed for color. A lot of corporations, a lot of marketing, a lot of branding is all based around colors and the way these corporations trigger our brains for certain things, money, health, abundance, whatever it is. And at what time did these corporations start to understand that the triggering facts of what color can do to the human psyche?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have to recount a statistic that we use at the Pantone Color Institute a good bit, that over 90% of a decision to purchase is based on visual information. Think of how powerful, right, that one sense becomes as we're trying to make decisions. And that over 80% of that decision is color alone. And this comes from a really deep-seated place in us. If you think about how we evolved as a species, as hunter-gatherers, we needed to perceive change, motion, difference, and distinction within our environment. And what a tool is color to help us do that? Is something ripe? Is something sweet? Is something alive? Is something dead, right? Is something new? Is something old and worn? We needed eyesight to be as prime as it is. So I think corporations start to capitalize on our innate ability, the acute ability that we have to distinguish and make judgments based on the visual. And corporations weren't the first ones to do that. You know, if you think of all the symbolism that, for example, monarchs and protesters have used throughout the ages to identify themselves as with or against a certain cause, It's pretty amazing.
So what about the use of multiple colors in these, you know, with eBay's or Google's versus mm-hmm. a simple Coca-Cola? What's the reason for using multiple different colors, and what does that trigger in our brains to allow us to see it in a different way?
Yeah. Well, if you look at some of the brands that use multiple color in their symbolism. So think of, do you remember the launch of the iMac computer where you had choices in terms of your casing colors, right? There were these beautiful, playful, rainbowy kind of colors. Think of M&Ms who use all those different colors, right, in their presentation. I think it's a way to describe the company as being relevant to everyone, or the product as being relevant to everyone, right? It's open like the rainbow. And we even see the rainbow being put to purpose, right, for you know, gay rights and inclusion. The rainbow in its fullness becomes a symbol of inclusion because it represents, quote unquote, all colors.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a great conversation about color with Keith Recker. He is a creative director at the Pantone Institute, and he has a new book called Deep Color. Keith, what is the Pantone Color Institute? I think most of us have seen it maybe on a color deck, or what exactly do you all do there?
Yeah, well, the Pantone company was founded by a really amazing guy named Larry Herbert, whom I've had the privilege to meet a few times in the late 60s. He started this thing called the Pantone Matching System, PMS, because as a press man, right, he would be on press. He, I think, got a little weary of arguing with designers that the color he was printing was not the color that they had specified. So he developed an ink mixing system that could produce dependable color day in and day out. There was no more arguing, right? If you tell me it's PMS 1414, I give you PMS 1414, and we need no longer, you know, argue with each other. That became so powerful, it caught on so quickly that PMS became a color standard around the world. And think, as globalism, as global sourcing grew, the effectiveness of being able to communicate to somebody in India, China, somewhere far away, your color specifications was pretty great. So it's expanded now. It's not just an ink library. It's a textile library. It's powder coats. It's transparent plastics, solid plastics. It's digital. And the Pantone Color Institute provides some thought leadership around communicating in color, what color means, what's coming in color. Right. It's something that sort of houses itself around the technical side of the business.
Color is so personal. I remember as a little kid, and I wonder if a lot of kids think through this. I always wondered that when my mom looked at the sky and saw blue, she was actually seeing the same thing that I was seeing when I looked at the sky that I called blue. Mm-hmm. And we will never know, right? Or I don't think, maybe we would. Can we tell what other people are seeing or experiencing?
No, we can't. And that's one of the most fascinating things, I think, for me. When light hits our retinas, we have three sets of color perceiving cones in our eyes. And each of those sets is tuned more or less to a particular range of frequencies. So we have some sets as red, tuned to red, some sets tuned to blue, and some sets tuned to green. Our eyes see in RGB technology, right? And it's the overlapping of those wavelengths that create our color perception. When you really look closely, what happens? The light hits one of those cells and a protein called a chromophore expands or contracts. And it's these movements of protein in our retina that send signals along the optical nerve into our brain. Like every machine, like a watch, like an old-fashioned clock, like every machine, there will be variations in how those proteins move and the enzymes that movement gives way to and the processing of that color in the brain. So there's absolutely no guarantee that your mother's blue sky is being perceived in the same way as your blue sky. And yet we've created a system of language and symbols that have deep historical reference, as well as things that are changing even today, all based around color. So it's no wonder we have to have long conversations, perhaps arguments, about what something looks like, what it means, how we use it, how we're going to use it. It's completely fascinating, I think.
In the US, we obviously have our political parties, which are represented by red and blue. And so what are those two particular colors? What does red represent and strike in the human psyche, and what does that do with blue as well?
Yeah, well, can I tell you an anecdote about how we get to red and blue here in the US? It's totally by accident. A technician in a back room at CNN during the 2000 election had to make, as they were creating their first magic boards, right, creating a way to deliver results precinct by precinct, state by state, had to make a decision about who was going to get red and who was going to get blue, because white was not a particularly effective graphic color on TV. And our country is represented by red, white, and blue. Up to 2000, both parties used red, white, and blue equally. So a technician in the back room at CNN gives red to Republicans and blue to Democrats, upending quite a long history of red being associated more with leftist causes like communism and the Labour Party in England, and blue being associated more with the Conservative Party in England, the Royal House of France, much more the Virgin Mary, much more careful conservative usage. So that random decision in a room in Atlanta, out of sight, has had some really interesting reversals of centuries of color tradition. It's interesting, I think, having team colors, brand colors, if you will, for the left of center and the right of center has not helped us. I think it's actually created more of a sense of combat and division than it has an ability to discuss. It's like you're rooting for your favorite team now. You're not discussing the issues anymore.
I mean, that's the truth. You mentioned something about the shade of emojis, and it's such a common theme in our society. And then I think way back to just the smiley face on a shirt, like Forrest Gump, have a nice day. You know, why is it yellow, and why do the emoji translate through the cell phone era and Apple and all these people? Why yellow?
Yeah, well, part of the point that I'm trying to get across in the book about color is that every color has its negative associations and its positive associations. And on the positive side of yellow, there's a sense of optimism and cheerfulness and happiness because of its affiliation with sunshine, right? When pure white sunlight enters our atmosphere, some of the blue wavelengths scatter across the molecules in our atmosphere, which is why we have a blue sky, because these blue wavelengths are scattering across the gas molecules. And what comes to us from sunlight then is slightly tinted yellow. So there is a reason that we affiliate a little bit of cheerfulness and optimism with yellow. Your question about emojis does link directly back to the smiley face. And there's a great anecdote that I tell in the book about a graphic designer named Harvey Ball, who is approached by an insurance company who's just bought an affiliate several states away. They're having a real challenge merging the two company cultures together, and they have a morale issue. So they approach Harvey saying, we have a morale issue. How do we make people, you know, ease up and laugh and feel better? And I guess in just a few minutes, he creates this yellow smiley face with a hand-drawn smile and two slightly asymmetrical eyes. He got $60 or $40 for it. He got almost nothing for it. And yet a few years later, other people grab the copyrights of somebody in US and somebody in Europe, and it becomes this global phenomenon. Some of us are old enough to remember the stickers, the patches, the notebooks, the erasers, all with this yellow smiley face. Not very long after, you know, in 1990 or so, a Japanese cell phone company called SoftBank hires the European, if I'm right about this, the European copyright holder of the smiley face to design the first emojis. And of course, you know, there's an adaptation of that yellow smiley face, which remains with us today. So Harvey Ball, you know, he never made much money off of that. There, I guess some of his heirs fought for some copyrights, and they set up a charitable foundation to give away what money they were able to get back out of the smiley face global phenomenon. But, you know, it was just one guy, much like the CNN decision, one guy in the back of a room being creative, and boom, it sticks.
It's funny how much we assign emotion and feeling to color, like you've just talked about with yellow. And I have a funny relationship with yellow. I never choose it, even though I agree with everything that you've just said. For some reason, yellow is off-putting to me, and I'm an orange person. And I'm wondering about orange because I, you know, when the in the World Cup soccer, when the Dutch team came out with their orange, it's something I've always loved about the Netherlands, that they are so into orange. And then orange also as a color of spirituality, and like the Rajneesh people and all their orange. Talk to us a little bit about how orange gets in there.
I'm with you. Orange is one of my favorites too. Like pink, it's one of the last color terms to enter English and other Western languages. And it only enters the language when the fruit, the orange, comes to Europe through global commerce, right? So this is the 15, 1600s. It comes from a Sanskrit and Dravidian word for fragrance, naru. That's why I love that about it. There's an interesting thing that I'm jumping around a little bit here, I know, but there's an interesting thing about how the Inca people see orange. They see it caught between red and yellow in the rainbow. And red is the color of kings and rulers, and yellow is the color of the gods. And they say that orange must be the color of people because we are sandwiched in between rulers and gods. love that interpretation of orange. It makes it so human.
Oh, I love that too. That, yeah. That makes all kinds of sense. We're speaking with Keith Recker. His book is called Deep Color. What a fun book this is, Keith. And for anyone who loves color, I just think that it's so rich. And then also to learn more about color, we have this ongoing argument in our family about color. My husband's an artist and he has a painting company and he regularly consults on color and I should just trust him all the time. But sometimes he'll say, oh, let's paint this room X color with this color on the trim. And I think that is the worst suggestion ever. But I trust him and he puts it up and it looks wonderful. But we argue about the color of my car. I call it charcoal. He calls it blue. And I'm just wondering how we become more attuned to the color wheel and more attuned to hues. And is it something that we can train ourselves to do?
Well, you know, nature and nurture are forever. That's forever a question, isn't it? What are we born with and able to do because it's within us? And what do we train ourselves to do? And I think seeing is, of course, somewhere on that continuum. Most of us see with those three sets of cones, those color perceiving cones, right? And that's called being a trichromat. You see three sets of colors. There's some evidence that 25% of women and only 8% of men, I apologize to all the men out there, have a fourth set of color perceiving cones, which takes them from, say, the 10 million shades of color that a trichromat can see to 100 million shades of color. And think of how that innate ability to discern blue out of gray or pale pink out of white, it would make your going through the world an intensely colorful and visual experience, right? You'd find all the nuances. Now, that said, if you're not born with that quality, you can, I believe, back up and be somewhat trained to perceive those differences. Being conscious of the color of light and the distortion coming to you from, say, yellow lamplight or slightly greenish office light or pure or white sunlight, you can start to kind of figure out what's going on, but it takes conscious thought, I would say.
In my businesses, I love branding. I love the building the logos. I love sitting down and looking at the color wheels. And when I go onto like something like an Adobe color and the Pantone colors, is there an endless amount of colors? Because you just said someone can see 100 million different shades. So there's just an endless amount of combinations because you can put 0.5% of blue and 1.3% of yellow and you can't end the combination color.
I would say within that range of trichromat vision, we can see 10 million shades, across the spectrum, across the Roy G. Biv spectrum. Whether or not those shades can be delivered in the technology in which you're creating is another question, right? So the computer screen can't capture all the distinctions visible to the eye. When you get to those secondary and tertiary colors, you do start to skip some steps, right? Because the technology can't keep up with the refinement of the full human visual experience. When you switch to printing, it's even more, I would say, a struggle to catch some of those distinctions. But, you know, creating with full awareness of everything that's possible in the human vision is really inspiring. And it's really kind of amazing. You just have to be watchful through the technology that you're going to deliver your creations with. And when you start to mix creations, mix media, so you need a logo that renders digitally in printing, at events, you know, on clothing, you start to get to the need to arrive at a dependable color that can be matched, which is one of the services that Pantone offers.
My go-to colors are black, white, and gray. And I have a lot of friends that are always telling me, I need more color in my life. You need more color, but I just can't get away. They match with everything. The majority of my clothes, as you can see, my shirt, my hat, black, white, and gray is what I wear. So what does that say about me and my personality, my character, just with those particular clothings?
The first chapter in Deep Color is about the color black. And I started there for a few reasons. And one of them is that for me, you know, think about myths of creation or creation stories from all over the world. They almost always begin in darkness. right? Multiculturally, so profound, they begin in darkness. And darkness for me is the moment before everything begins. It has all the potential of everything possible that could happen. And I love that about it, right? It's ready like the Big Bang to explode into the next thing. So Black is full of potential. There's also a strand of Black that has a lot to do with probity and seriousness. And that comes to us, you know, quite a lot through the use of Black in the Catholic Church. And I trace it in the book back to the second Saint Benedict. I could go on and on about these things, so I'm skipping some steps. But the second Saint Benedict was asked by Charlemagne to unify monastic life across Europe. And he dictated that Black would be the color of monks. And his own order were the Benedictines. And they became serious centers of learning all around Western Europe. So this association between the Black robe and achievement, education, seriousness, and, you know, a few centuries later, Habsburgs of Spain adopting Black as their court, official court color, and they take it all over the world as a symbol of power, seriousness, and potential, with negative aspects too, right? I mean, the colonial behavior of European powers is pretty condemnable at this point, but nonetheless, Black remains with us as a symbol of power, seriousness, and potential. So I think good for you as a creative person, right? Black is a really amazing choice.
There you go, David. Good way to defend your position. Speaking of, you know, the whites and then colors, I just have to ask you, because it is, you know, the holiday season, and I can't believe the number of conversations that I've had, you know, in celebrating Christmas and putting up a Christmas tree. Are we going to do the beautiful, classy little white lights and no color, or are we doing all of the color? And why is this such a conversation? And what do you think that the two different types of holiday lights portray?
Okay, so this being one of those potentially divisive conversations, Lynn, I have to come out and say that I have been a proponent of white lights for a little while now, in part because I feel like it sets the stage for everything else you're going to do, right? It's like a background. But I really am very receptive to the notion that having the multicolor situation is more celebratory and more fun. So I think it's really, you know, to paraphrase politicians, it's a subject about which good people can disagree.
Oh, well, I never thought I could have such a long conversation about color, but I still have all these questions in my mind that we don't have time for. So we will just thank you, Keith Recker.